We're quite a diverse lot, we New Yorkers, and people have a lot of different jobs that most of us don't even know exist. In August, we're going to be interviewing people with unusual jobs, and if you would like to participate, write to us under the heading Odd Jobs at lopecho@wnyc.org. Mike Wallace has been a fixture in American living rooms for as long as I can remember. He's one of the most important people in the field of television journalism, and it was a real honor when he came on my show this past January. The occasion was the publication of his new memoir, Between You and Me, from Hyperion, and we thought you might want to hear it again. So here's the conversation I had with Mike Wallace.
Can I call you Lenny?
Sure, why not?
Okay.
Like Oprah, I'm a little hesitant to do memoirs these days. I'm hoping I won't say anything about this book cited on the Smoking Gun website. Is that likely?
You know something? I have a confession to make.
You never spent time in prison.
No. But that Fry book has scared the dickens out of me. So I suddenly realized, you're the first person to hear it from me, I write, Edward Devotion was an early hero in the American Revolution. True. On the night that Paul Revere made his legendary ride through Boston and neighboring towns, his friend and fellow patriot, Devotion, mounted his horse and went on a similar gallop to sound the alarm the British were coming. The course he followed took him through Brookline, which is my hometown, by the way. I suppose the main reason Devotion's ride of warning had been so overshadowed is because many years later, when Longfellow sat down to write his famous ballad, Revere happened to be the horseman he chose to immortalize. All untrue. I didn't realize this.
I've heard that story many times.
Yeah. It was... And when I say all untrue, the Wallace family lived across Harvard Street from the Devotion School. Mm-hmm. And on the grounds of the Devotion School... This is not the end of the world, but on the grounds of the Devotion School is the Devotion House. And we were told that was the house that Edward Devotion had lived in. Well, the fact of the matter is that Edward Devotion was dead by the time that Paul Revere made... He was indeed a hero of the American Revolution, but he had died the way I've finally begun to understand it, was in, I think, 1675.
I don't think anybody's going to call you on this one, Mike. But what about this whole business about the significance of the truth or truthiness? Because this is something that I'm sure you've thought a lot about. Oprah doesn't claim to be a journalist, but I assume the rules are different for someone like you.
Yes. No, it's very important. The truth could not be more important. The truth, accuracy, compassion. The desire, if one can, to find something new to tell people about.
But that may be what's leading to this growing trend in recent years of journalists with a point of view. We've most notably on Fox, as people have pointed out, but we're also seeing it to a lesser degree on CNN, and it's even creeping in to the networks, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The look, there was a time, and you could bet the farm on the fact that you would not know Walter Cronkite's point of view. Huntley and Brinkley, same. Howard K. Smith, by and large, the same. But that was three networks. 6:30 at night. Who watched? Everybody watched. And Cronkite was the most trusted man in America. Now there are 300 of these people.
So there's pressures on people to do something to make them distinctive?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The look, Len, you want to get circulation. You want to get attention. You're on a cable. And so you will do, and I watched a lot of it and so forth. There is the desire to say, hey, I'm doing something different from what everybody else is doing, and that's going to get me circulation, and that is going to get me attention, and that's going to get me in the newspapers, I suppose.
But Don Hewitt, the creator of 60 Minutes, once told me that he thought true objectivity was an impossible goal for anyone, and he's not the only one who feels that way. You look at a story, and you just can't help but telling it in your own way, and people might pick up subtle hints, even if you're not aware that you're doing it.
I know that. But you owe it to Cronkite, in a sense. You owe it to CBS News, if you can, to be objective, to be dispassionate, to tell the truth, and not to use it. You're not. And Eric Severide was an analyst.
And he was presented as such.
That's exactly right. But you didn't often feel his point of view. He analyzed.
But haven't you made good use over the years of your ability to raise just one eyebrow? That's sending a message to the audience.
It does. That's why, what about you? When you raise your eyebrow, no one sees.
Except the guest.
That's correct.
That's why I don't raise my eyebrows very much. Actually, my brother used to accuse me of raising my eyebrows whenever I was lying. And so he called it the LBJ effect. And so whenever I would say, now, honest, and he'd say, Leonard, you're raising your eyebrows right now. And it was the greatest weapon he ever devised. The first show you did in a news interview format was Nightbeat, which was a local show, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What was the premise? What made it different at the time?
We did Ted Yates, my old pal and partner, and to whose widow I'm married. Ted Yates and I decided, he used to work for Tex and Jinx. You're old enough to remember that.
Sure.
Tex and Jinx were the Mr. and Mrs., the most famous, I guess, well, Ed and Pagene Fitzgerald.
There were actually three on OR, Dorothy and Dick as well.
Right. Dorothy.
And in all cases, the wives were as famous as the husbands, because mm-hmm. Jinx Falkenberg, hadn't she been a Miss Rheingold?
She was.
Mm-hmm.
She was.
And Dorothy Kilgallen, well, that's pretty famous.
Damn right.
So anyway, so you were telling us about what was it? Oh, Tex and Jinx.
Yes.
I'm getting totally lost here. You don't digress this much on 60 Minutes, Mark.
No, I'm not permitted to. You know something? There's nothing. We don't ad lib on 60 Minutes.
Do you write all of those scripts yourself?
No. You know something? Writing is a difficult chore for me. Because when you write for television, you write 30 seconds here, 45 seconds there, a minute there, 15 seconds there. And the rest of the writing is in the picture and the people what the people we interview talk about.
Sure. I mean, you can never know. You can always tell a bad interviewer because it's somebody who doesn't follow up, who doesn't seem to be listening to what the guest says.
Correct.
My guest is Mike Wallace, who's written with the help of Gary Paul Gates, because he doesn't like to write all by himself, a memoir called Between You and Me. It includes an 82-minute DVD of some of his most famous interviews, and
it is
published by Hyperion.
That's the best part of it, the DVD, because it's a real one of your colleagues here who was showed me the way in said that she played it for her son, and suddenly she realized that it's a course. That DVD is a course in current history. Out of the mouths of the people who made the history. Everybody from Eleanor Roosevelt, Margaret Sanger, Vanessa Redgrave, actors, artists, crooks, and
Mickey Cohen.
In other words, for young people particularly, from the age of 14, 15, her son's 14. And she said he was absolutely fascinated. He couldn't believe he was seeing history in front of him.
I have to give a station ID. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. And you've had the opportunity to talk to all those people. I know that that's something I'm often, my friends always joke about me saying, oh, she's been on the show. Oh, he's been on the show.
Of course.
But there is something wonderful about having had the opportunity to speak to all of these people, some of whom you've admired all your life. But you, with Nightbeat, you started doing something that also was different. You started being confrontational. Was that something that was part of the concept from the start?
That was part of the concept from the Look. You've been on the radio interviewing forever, and you're not particularly confrontational, are you?
My feeling is that it's difficult to be confrontational to somebody seated across from me. But if the person is evil, you know, if Adolf Hitler were here, I'd be giving him a hard time. But Mike Wallace, you've done good things in your life, and you've probably done a few things that you're really embarrassed by.
Correct.
But I have no desire to destroy Mike Wallace just for the sheer joy of it.
Well, you know, pardon me. Is there a button I'm supposed to push?
There is actually a cough button. But, you know, I didn't know you were coming. I would have supplied a spittoon, Mike.
Ted Yates and I decided. We were doing a newscast on Channel 5 at 11 o'clock at night. And it was a half-hour newscast, first half-hour television newscast in New York. That was a big deal. And then Ted said, you know something? We have an audience. Why don't we do something different from the pablum that most television interviews are? Let's do something, and he named it Nightbeat, in which we really do a lot of research about people and confront people and no apologies for it, confront people with the errors that they have made, the foolish things they have said. You know, I read this about you, and I would then mention, and in effect, you're a wife beater. I didn't realize that. Well, you can imagine.
Yeah, well, I can imagine doing that three shows and then nobody wanted to come on.
Oh, they wanted to come on and wrestle. They really did. We were self-consciously, well, the audience simply, suddenly, I was absolutely anonymous prior to that in New York, and it was a local show. And suddenly, people said, did you watch Wallace and what he asked?
Somebody said there's no such thing as an indiscreet question.
That was Faye Emerson. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Faye?
Yes.
Who was married to Skitch? There is no such thing as an indiscreet question. And if you have a question that you want to ask me, no matter how tough...
I may. But right now, I'm more interested in picking your brain.
Okay.
Because I think that's interesting, too. First of all, do you think that you've mellowed at all? Are you just as likely to come in with those ambush questions today as you did when you started?
If I can't, yeah, I like to do them because I have a reputation for doing them. Because sometimes sometimes you make news. You know something, when that unexpected question comes and you are talking and looking into the eyes of the interviewee as you and I are looking at each other right now, and we're about 3 yards but under the lights, and you're only a couple of yards or maybe 4 or 5 feet from each other, you can see it hit, and you can see the brain go, and you can see the pulse go a little faster.
And Martin Short has done wonderful comedy based on
that. That's right.
Well, then you were picked up by the network. The show must have changed to some degree.
Mm-mm. It was only once a week, you see.
Well, didn't the legal department start wondering about whether you can get away with this on national television?
Oh, well, that's because I made a big mistake along the way. And I, you know something? At my age, you begin to really forget things. How old are you?
Younger than you. Now, I'm 65.
Oh, you are an adolescent.
Yeah, I said you're I'm still an inspiration to youngsters like me.
I'm 87. Why did that suddenly come up?
Because you were thinking of Drew Pearson and that whole problem.
Correct, correct.
I'm also a mind reader. And I read your book.
Did you like it moderately?
I liked it, yeah.
And did you watch the DVD?
I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, for Pete's sake, Len.
Well, one thing at a time.
I know, but I promise you, you'll give me a call after you see the DVD and you'll say, you know, you're right, Mike. You're right.
My researcher took it to work on this. But so you had Drew Pearson on your show. People probably under 60 don't remember who Drew Pearson is, but he was
the Bob Novak of his day.
And Jack Anderson's boss, for people who remember Jack Anderson.
That's correct.
And he had some problems with the Kennedy campaign.
That's correct.
So why was that a problem?
Well,
you were threatened with legal action from Clark Clifford, weren't you?
Sue the bastard for $50 million or whatever. That was from the father. What it was the Jack Kennedy, who was in from my hometown. We went to the Edward Devotion School together.
He also thought that Edward Devotion rode the same night as Paul Revere.
That's correct. What happened was that Drew Pearson said, this ambitious young man who got a Pulitzer Prize for Profiles in Cars, he never wrote the book and never acknowledged it. And I said, wait a second now. Jack Kennedy didn't write Profiles in Courage and got a Pulitzer Prize? He said, that's my own. Well, who wrote it? Well, I don't remember, said Pearson. It turned out that when I came back to him, that it was Ted Sorensen.
Who still denies it. I had him on my show, and he said he didn't do it.
Yeah,
but everybody says he did.
That is correct. Herbert Parmet, who was an extraordinarily accurate and thoughtful historian, did a huge amount of research, and Jack Kennedy, he was ill at the time anyway, he was on his back, and he had a lot of the notes. And Jack, I say Jack, we grew up, as I said, in the same town. He invited me down to Washington to see him in his office after Pearson accused him of not having written the book, and he showed me the notes and things of that nature. When a guy wants to run for president, and that's what this was all about, occasionally he gets caught out.
We'll take a little break and come back with more Mike Wallace, who has written a memoir called Between You and Me, which includes an 82-minute DVD of his most famous interviews, if that's possible to jam into 82 minutes. The book is published by Hyperion. We will continue right after this. We're back with Mike Wallace, who is celebrating 60 years in the news business. He has won countless awards for his work, including the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award, 3 Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Awards, 3 George Foster Peabody Awards, a Robert E. Sherwood Award.
Knock it off, Lenny, please.
He's in the Television Hall of Fame. And he has written a memoir with the help of Gary Paul Gates called Between You and Me. It's published by Hyperion. Now, you knew the Reagans. They were the only first family that you had known before he became president. Does that create difficulties? Is it difficult to have dinner with someone one night and then do a balance piece on them the next.
It is difficult, yeah. What happened was I knew Nancy Reagan's mother in Chicago. We were good pals in the green room. She was a soap opera actress. And in the green room in Chicago, we got to know each other because I was doing a newscast on WBBM there locally at the time. And she couldn't have been more different from her mother, Nancy. Mm-hmm. Edie Davis loved a good dirty joke, told a good dirty joke. She was a bawdy, lovely, interesting, friendly woman, married to a neurosurgeon, conservative as he could be, by the name of Loyal Davis. Was that the name?
I call him Mr. Davis.
That's right. Dr. Davis. In any case, Nancy, for some reason, and I hit it off. I met her fairly early, about the time that she was going to Smith College, and we just hit it off. We became good friends. I knew her before Ronnie knew her. And so when you do that kind of thing, you know somebody very well. And I used to dine occasionally with them at Chasen's Restaurant out in California. I liked Ronnie immensely. What you saw was what you got. He was comfortable in his skin. He was funny. He was dead honest. And Nancy, occasionally she would take after me. What happened was, the first
time... She was angered by some of the things you did when you interviewed him.
That's exactly right. After they...
Well, was it your sense that people were fair game once they agreed to come on and do a show with you?
We didn't have subpoena powers, and they knew the kind of questions that I asked. And so I figured, what the dickens? They know what they're getting into.
Maybe they felt that you were just too unfair or the question was too sharp.
You know something? Not really. Not really. There was...
Mm-mm. Well, Barbara Streisand sure felt that you were unfair.
Oh, well, Barbara Streisand, that's... Barbara Streisand, I met. I used to do a show back then called... What the heck was it? The Mike Wallace interview, I guess. In any case, we used to eat. This was on Channel 5. Yeah, this is 90. We used to eat at a little place called Oscar's Salt of the Sea on 3rd Avenue.
Remember it well.
And Oscar's Salt in the Sea, which was wonderful. Barbara Streisand at that time lived on the 5th story of a 5-story walk-up. And we became good pals. And I was... what happened was that after she became Barbara Streisand, if you know what I mean, she was never wrong. And she was always, in effect, how dare you ask me a question like that? Well, that's meat for the grinder. And so what I was happy to do was to ask her questions that would make her uncomfortable.
You ambushed her with a quote from her mother.
That's correct.
Barbara, so you weren't hurting her. Her mother was actually hurting her.
Yes. Yes. And her mother said, well, I said, do you see a lot of Barbara? Well, not a lot of Barbara, no. Really? Why not? Oh, Barbara. Barbara doesn't have time for me. Oh.
A Jewish mother being told that.
Can you imagine? And then I showed Barbara, her mother, on television, saying that to me. And she began to cry. And it was so funny.
Think it was mean at all? It's kind of a Geraldo moment, wasn't it?
Well, Geraldo does a reasonably good job, don't you agree?
when he's not trying to track down Osama bin Laden, I guess.
Oh, well, that's true. That's true. No, come on. It's what we try to do is to show the character, to show some of the soft spots in an otherwise hard individual. And Barber was the greatest voice imaginable, but she was a...
Well, her mother said she didn't have time to be close to anyone. Which is rather hurtful. I mean, on both sides, I imagine.
You wouldn't ask that kind of a question?
Nah.
Why?
Because I think there's a voyeuristic side to it that I don't enjoy watching or being part of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying you enjoy hurting people, but you see your job as being different than mine. My job, I think, is to find out as much about a person as I can. And mm-hmm. and then it often becomes obvious anyway, just in the course of an interview, what a person is like. And then I assume that the audience is figuring it out. And if members of the audience don't figure it out, well, you know, that's just too bad. I don't want to tell them
mm-hmm.
what they should think about this guest.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different style.
Listen, Leonard, you have been so successful for such a long time.
And I can't stand to see women cry, or men for that matter, or sweat. What about George W. Bush? He's the only president you haven't interviewed. He even turned you down when he was governor of Texas.
Yes, he did.
Well, do you think it's because he understands what
no
it would
idea.
Be like?
I have no idea what it's. He turned me down. He didn't turn me down. To this day, I have never shaken hands with George W. Bush. This is the first president.
Jack Abramoff got many opportunities.
That's correct. George W. Bush is the only president that I have not shaken hands with since Abe Lincoln. When he was governor, I wanted to go down there and do a story about tort reform. Karl Rove was his designer, if you will, at that time. And Karl Rove said, Mr. Wallace, yes, Mr. Rove, you're not going to talk to the governor. He doesn't want to talk to you. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to let him talk to you. We did the piece. It was a good piece, and it was something that would not particularly have done any serious damage to the governor of Texas. And so I figured once he came here to the East, Karl Rove has never let me do it.
Well, maybe he thinks you're going to interview Barbara and get some something that would make George upset.
Oh, poor pupsy.
On the DVD, I was very moved by the interview with Clint Hill, who had been President Kennedy's Secret Service agent.
Oh.
Why do you think he agreed to do that interview?
You know something? He had a guilty conscience. He was convinced that he was responsible for the death of JFK. He was the Secret Service man, detailed on that awful day to cover, take care of, and so forth, both Jack Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy. Secret Service, take it very seriously. And he was running along, trailing them in Dallas on that day, and he genuinely believed.
And that is very moving because we could see that in him. That's one thing that television really gives you.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a lot of time, so we can't get into some of the big crises, the things that you talk about here. But I'm sure you prefer it wouldn't have happened the way they turned out. The General William Westmoreland, the Jeffrey Wigand incident, and the movie that came out as a result of that.
Jeffrey Wigand is a very good friend of mine. He is my hero. He has more to do with the fact that fewer people are smoking today than before. He's really, really, as a matter of fact, I heard from Jeffrey.
I meant the movie that came out of it, The Insider.
Oh, The Insider.
Yeah.
Well, that was, that was just dishonest. Dishonest movie making. It was a reasonably good movie, and the premise originally for the movie was sensible, but drama was more important than the truth. when they made that movie.
Well, in the movie, don't you make your character make a derogatory remark about public radio?
Ostensibly, yes.
That the last thing you want to do is to be in the backwaters of public radio.
That's correct.
I took that personally.
I know you did. Can you imagine? You had a good time when they had me quoted as, what am I going to wind up in public radio like Walter Cronkite? I mean, it was such... I hate to use the word bullshit, but I mean, it really was.
Well, Roger Mudd, I think, wound up in public... Didn't he wind up in public radio? Anyway, and he was a pretty good guy. Do you regret some of the things you did?
Mm-mm.
Well, TV Guide went after you after the Westmoreland case.
So what?
Uh-huh. You're still there.
The fact of the matter is that General William Westmoreland lied to the American people about the number of troops in Vietnam, enemy troops. He said no more than 300,000. Sam Adams, who worked for the CIA, said 600,000. Westy said to me on the air, if I were to have told the truth, he didn't say it quite that way, all support for the war in Vietnam would disappear. As a result of which, he sued me and CBS and so forth for $120 million. It was proven at trial, that everything that we said in that broadcast was accurate.
But the trial made you ill, didn't it?
It drove me into a depression. I had no idea what the dickens it was. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. You've never had that trouble?
No.
Good for you.
General Westmoreland never sued me for millions of dollars. That's because I'm a nice guy, Mike.
That's true. He was a nice guy, too. Westy was.
Mel Brooks took offense when you interviewed him about the producers, the show version, because you suggested it was his creative peak.
Well, was it?
I don't know. Yeah. I like the movie as well.
Me too. But no, Mel hated it. Mel hated it because don't. I don't want to hear that I'm 75 years old. I don't need to hear that from you and so forth.
Well, what about you? Do you feel that you still have some good years left?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm going to be 88. Come on.
But you're still, you know, you're 88. You're still buying meatloaf at the local...
You know something?
restaurant.
What's the name? 249-7070. Come on, what's the name of the place?
What, the place where you were buying the meatloaf?
I bought it last night again.
That must be some meatloaf after what you went through.
It's the best damn meatloaf you have ever tasted in your life, Linda.
Is that Luke's?
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Well, I have never had their meatloaf, but, you know, right now we know that millions of people are calling Luke's and ordering some meatloaf.
Well, it's the Mike Wallace meatloaf. I don't get royalties on it, but it's $10.95.
Meanwhile, there's this book called Between You and Me, a memoir written with Gary Paul Gates. Was it fun collaborating with him?
Oh, yes. I had done it 20 years before in a book called Close Encounters, which was... talked about everything before the past 20 years. And
yeah, but you didn't have a DVD with that book.
No, that's right.
And this one does have an 82-minute DVD of some of Mike Wallace's most famous interviews. And
you know who's on that DVD? Wait a minute.
Okay.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Eleanor Roosevelt, back in 1957. Margaret Sanger. I've got a list of them someplace.
Well, we've run out of time, Mike. My guest is Mike Wallace. His recent memoir is Between You and Me. Thanks a lot, Mike.